So the Finance Committee will come to order. Today's February the 10th. Today on the agenda, we have the mental health budget and the operating budget. Joining me today are my co-chairman, Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, and Senator Regan. The other two members should be joining us shortly. I'd like to remind everybody to turn off any electronics that they might have so that they don't disrupt the meeting. But today we're going to, as I said, go over the two operating budgets and then finish up on any items that committee members might have questions on Senate Bill 253, the appropriations for the deferred maintenance and replacement, and Senate Bill 254, the supplemental capital and other operations. So with that, we'll get started with Karen Rayfield. Please approach the table and identify yourself for the record. While she's coming up, the operating budget, for the general public's information, the budget will be going into having hearings with the subcommittee chairman, and they will be reporting back to the full finance committee later on in March. But for the chairman for the Department of Administration is Senator Olson. Members are Senator Pascavan and Dyson. Community and Economic Development is chaired by Senator Thomas, with members Senators Kukesh and Menard. Corrections, chaired by Senator Ellis, with members Senators Davis, French, and Pascavan. The court system is chaired by Senator Egan, and that is, his members are Senators Pascavan and Terrio. Senator Egan also has Education and Early Development with members Senators Davis, Menard, Meyer, and Stevens. Environmental Conservation is going to be chaired by Senator Ellis with members Pascavan and Wagner. I'll be chairing the Fish and Game budget with Senators Stedman and Stevens. Also, the governor's budget will be chaired by me with Senators Kukesh and Stevens. The Health and Social Services budget is going to be chaired by Senator Olson with members Senators Davis, McGuire, Meyer, and Willikowski. The Labor and Workforce Development is chaired by Senator Thomas with members Senators Davis and French. The Department of Law will be chaired by Senator Stedman with members Senators French and Meyer. The legislature, I'll be chairing that along with Senator Stedman and Stevens. Military and Veterans Affairs will be chaired by Senator Huggins with members Senators Kukesh and Willikowski. And Natural Resources will be also chaired by Senator Huggins with members Senators McGuire, Menard, and Willikowski. Public Safety will be chaired by Senator Olson with members Senator French, McGuire, Willikowski, and Bundy. Department of Revenue by Senator Stedman with Senators Hoffman and McGuire. Transportation will be chaired by Senator Stedman with members Senators Kukesh, Menard, Meyer, Olson, and Stevens. And I will be chairing the university's budget, and that will be members of the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
I think earlier you'd mentioned Senator Terrio is probably his replacement.
Right. Right, that's Senator Dyson, that's right. Senator Dyson on corrections.
Okay.
With that, Ms. Rayfield, the floor is yours for your presentation on the operating budget. We did have a preliminary hearing earlier on. I think Senator Stedman was chairing that, but a brief review of the operating budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Rehfeld. I'm the director of the Office of Management and Budget. I did appear before you on, I think, the 27th of January and provided an overview of the governor's proposed spending plan for FY 2011. Of course, that included the capital budget as well. So I'm not, at this time, prepared to go through that whole overview document with you, but it is available on the record. Also, so to highlight, the operating budget bill, Senate Bill 229, is before you today. As we rolled out that bill, the bill totals about $9.8 billion in all funds. The bill has 34 sections. There are several key elements in that bill. Both operating numbers and language sections will be before you for consideration. Fund capitalizations, debt service costs, special appropriations, including revenue sharing and other items, savings, and all other appropriations. So it's a significant bill. Clearly, through your subcommittee process, you will be spending a lot of time with our various departments and their program folks talking about what the details of those budgets, and we are prepared and willing to work with you on all of that. Some of the highlights of what is in the budget, I think when we talked earlier, there are some significant drivers in our budget from one year to the next. For the most part, those are going to be our statutory formula programs, education. We have about a $56 million increase in this budget related to our education school funding formula. Of course, there are increases in Medicaid. In our December budget, that increase is about $36 million above where we were in the FY10 budget. As you know, we have supplemental requests that we discussed briefly yesterday for Medicaid, and we also will be considering budget amendments on that particular program. We're seeing increases in the enrollment, the utilization, and the cost of providing Medicaid services. So those are significant elements of the budget that I know we will be spending more time on. The retirement system, unfunded liability, as you know, we have taken on that debt, and we are working that down every year. In the 11 budget, we see about a $73 million increase related to our unfunded liability. Debt service, again, we have funded some of our capital investments with financing options, so our debt service on an annual basis is about $276 million. That is about a $29 million increase in the FY11 budget before you. The governor was very interested, of course, in holding the line on agency operating growth. Agencies will be required to absorb increases in their budgets. There are a few areas, though, specifically in the area of domestic violence and sexual assault. The governor's initiative to prevent domestic violence and sexual assault. We are investing about $7 million of new general fund between the departments of law and public safety for that effort. So as you go through your budgets in detail at the subcommittee level, I think you will see that we tried very hard to hold the line on that state agency growth while meeting the needs of our formula programs and those services that Alaskans expect from their government. So with that, Mr. Chairman, there are a number of people in the room. There are also folks online if the committee has specific questions at this time, or we can reserve that for subcommittee work.
As it relates to the supplemental, I think you made some comments yesterday that if the supplemental is approved where there are increments, those would be there would be amendments forthcoming to address that in the 11 budget.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. In some of the areas of the supplemental bill, we had already anticipated that there was a correction needed in the budget, so we put it in the December 14 budget that's before you now. There are a few areas that we need to address in the amended budget. Those amendments will come to you next week. They're due on the 30th day, which is the 17th of February.
And when would you anticipate addressing labor contracts?
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware that we will have an agreement on labor contracts by the budget amendment deadline. Of course, as soon as we have those agreements, we will forward them to you.
Okay, are there questions of members of the Finance Committee on the operating budget? Seeing none, thank you for that presentation. And as I said, the committees already started their subcommittee process, many of them, and look forward to working with the administration to complete that process. With that, we have the Senate Bill 231, the mental health budget. We have some opening remarks. Jeff Jesse, please come to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mental health, the comprehensive mental health budget contains operating and capital items. I'm very pleased that Mr. Jesse is here with us this morning to talk about that. We, of course, in your subcommittee process, you will be going through those along with the regular operating budget bill that we just talked about, and I'm delighted to turn it over to Mr. Jesse.
Jeff Jesse, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And you have should have in front of you a PowerPoint presentation, and I'll be going through that this morning, and you can make reference to it. I'm going to go through these first several slides pretty quickly. On slide two, I think this committee is pretty familiar with our beneficiaries, people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism, Alzheimer's disease, and related dementia. You know, there are other associated, of course, beneficiaries, people with traumatic brain injury, that sort of thing. So that's the people that we serve. We see on slide three, we do have a number of trust advisors. We don't do this work in a vacuum. We have a lot of folks that provide input to the trustees and recommendations, and you can see them listed there on slide three. Moving into slide four, you'll see what the trust allocation for funding is for fiscal year 2011. That $24,870,000 is basically stable from FY 2010. We actually weathered the economic downturn, I think, in frankly better shape than the vast majority of foundations around the country. Although we did lose a little over $90 million at one point in the permanent fund, the trust's financial structure is extremely robust. We have, as you can see, a percentage payout from our principal fund, but we also have an income reserve account that is set at four times our annual payout. And so even in years like last year when we're taking significant reductions in our assets, we're able to continue to make the payout, which is, of course, critical to maintain our effort for the programs that serve our beneficiaries and to keep our commitments in the many partnerships that we have with the state. So again, I think when you compare it to other foundations, we fared actually pretty well over the course of the economic downturn, and now as things start to pick up, we anticipate our available revenue will probably go up in the future years as we replenish our reserve as well. If you look on page five, you'll see our joint legislative priorities with a number of our partners. One, of course, is to increase the adult dental Medicaid reimbursement cap. We originally set that cap when we added dental to the Medicaid program based upon the cost of one plate of dentures. The idea being that a person could get a complete set of dentures if they worked 2 years of their cap. Well, costs have gone up since then. It's no longer possible to get a set of dentures within the cap that is placed on the dental program. So we're looking at getting an adjustment to that this year. The next one is to establish a regular and periodic schedule of rate reviews for home and community-based services. SB 32 is the vehicle for this. We've talked about this before. The most expensive level of care is hospital and nursing home services. And the only way to avoid that level of care and those costs to the state is to continue to support home and community-based services. They keep people in their homes and their natural environments. They keep them in the community. They're cost-effective. Whereas hospital and nursing homes have the benefit of regular rate reviews to reflect their increasing cost of doing business, such as not the case with community-based services. And so we go through this seemingly never-ending cycle of having the capacity of these programs, and I'm talking about everything from group homes for people with developmental disabilities, assisted living homes, those sorts of programs. We watch their capacity degrade over time as we keep rates frozen. We end up in a crisis situation. Programs are forced to come to the brink of closure. We come to the legislature. There's a reactive response. There's a short-term adjustment in rates. And we're doing okay for a while, and then we start to slide down into the pit once again. And so what we're hoping is that you will see the wisdom of doing periodic reviews so that these services can continue to maintain their level of effort over time. And so we're very interested in supporting that legislation. Next priority is supporting the 10-year plan to reduce homelessness. You know, I think we're making some very significant progress in this area. When we first started coming and talking to you about this a few years ago, we had a relatively small program in partnership with AHFC to deal with special needs housing. We talked about creating a housing trust. We didn't actually create the trust as we had originally conceived it, but the additional resources we have in housing now are being administered as, in essence, a virtual housing trust. And to remind you, the critical thing about special needs housing is you have to combine the three legs of the stool. You have to not only have capital, but you have to have the operating funds to maintain the operation of the facility, and you have to have the support service funding for the people that need supports to maintain that housing. And that's what we're able to do now with the expanded authority that you gave AHFC and the funding that has been allocated to this and which the trust has contributed to. There are some very exciting things I'll talk about as we go on in the presentation around housing and some of the initiatives that are showing some real success. And then finally, funding community coordinated transportation systems. You know, our beneficiaries often are dependent upon public transportation and transportation provided by nonprofit agencies to get to work, to get to doctor's appointments, to basically have any ability to participate in the community. However, we do believe that needs to be done in a cost-efficient and effective manner. And that means, frankly, not every nonprofit can have their own set of vans that sit there most of the time waiting for somebody to use them. To the greatest extent possible, we have to get coordinated transportation systems that better utilize those assets because, frankly, we just can't afford to have everybody sitting there with their own vans all the time and not utilizing them effectively. On slide six, I'm going to talk a little bit about our formula for success because towards the end, I want to address the governor's domestic violence and substance abuse initiative, which we are very excited about. And the formula for success that we have hit on for all of our focus areas starts with identifying the problem or community need. The next thing is to pull together the subject matter experts and the stakeholders into an effective, we call them working group, that goes through a pretty rigorous logic model exercise of developing what is our theory of change, what strategies are we seeking to employ, and probably the most important factor is it has to be data-driven. You cannot, in our opinion, achieve success in any of these initiatives If you aren't focused on data, you aren't watching what the data is telling you about the effectiveness of your intervention strategies, and as you discover that some are working better than others, which is inevitable, that you're able then to use that information to inform you in making changes to your strategies over time. Without that iterative process based upon data, initiatives are often handled in a throw money at it and come back in a couple of years and see if anything happened. And pretty much all you can be sure that's going to get you is that the money's going to get spent. Whether you end up with an outcome or not is another question. So that's a big focus for us. At the same time, we recognize that data costs money. You don't want to spend resources, including the time and effort of your providers, collecting information if you don't know ahead of time what you're going to do with it to change what you're doing. We have banned the phrase, "it would be interesting to know." It's easy to say, but it's costly to answer. And if you don't know ahead of time how you're going to use that information, then you ought not to be wasting money to acquire it. You can see on page 7 the 5 program focus areas that the trust has: bring the kids home, disability justice, workforce development, housing, and beneficiary projects. I want to go on to page 8 and give you an update on bring the kids home. You know, with all modesty, I have to say that this has been one of the most dramatically successful initiatives that I've ever been involved with, and we've done several, closing Harborview, building a new psychiatric hospital, and overhauling Anchorage's community mental health system, housing arena. I mean, we've done a lot of things, but this project has really transformed the children's mental health system in the state. As you can see in FY06, we had 743 Alaskan kids that ended up being served out of state. We're now referring less than 110 a year to out-of-state placements. In FY06, we were spending $40 million for out-of-state Medicaid costs for serving these kids. We've now cut that in half. And the trust, again, as in all of our work, we didn't do this alone, nor could we have done it alone. We did it by bringing together all of our partners, of course, Health and Social Services, the tribal health organizations, providers, parents, AHFC. We got everyone together, and we, again, have followed our strategic thinking of watching the data, and not everything we've tried in Bring the Kids Home has worked the way it was drawn up initially, and we've had to make changes over time. You can see on page 9, this is what we had shown you from the very beginning, and we continue to progress down this. We never promised that we would save the state money with this initiative. The intent always was to spend the money that you do spend in a more effective and helpful way by reinvesting the savings in out-of-state Medicaid to in-state services. And you can see as we continue each year, we come and we show you this chart, and then you can see that, in fact, not only are we successfully reinvesting these funds, but the overall cost of services in this sector are quite stable, and in fact have come down from their peak in FY07. So we want to continue this reinvestment process. The governor's budget has a number of increments that are related to this. If you look on page 10, this gives you some idea of the results that we have achieved. Out-of-state admits are down 85%. RPTC recidivism is down from 20% to 3.4%. That's huge. What that means is that when kids come out of residential psychiatric treatment, they're getting supports in the community. and they don't end up cycling back into that institutional level of care. And that's a huge indicator of success. One of the key components of the Bring the Kids Home initiative is individualized services. In a way, we're reinventing the Alaska Youth Initiative, which, you know, we've hammered this problem down once before. You know, in the late 80s, we actually reduced the number of kids out of state to just a handful. And we've learned a lesson from that. When we achieved that success, we all went away fat, dumb, and happy, and we stopped paying attention. And then woke up 10 years later and realized, well, now we got 400 and some kids out of state again. You know, we're not going to make that mistake again. When this initiative is completed, and by the way, there is an end to this initiative. We're planning to try to phase this out probably by the 2013 fiscal year. But we will leave in place not only a robust and effective children's mental health system, but also we'll continue to track key indicators so that if this thing starts to go south again, we're catching it before we get to the point where we've got a major overhaul project on our hands. But I do want to mention these individualized services. These have been tremendously important because, as you all know, we are still dealing with the legacy of Medicaid refinancing. We refinanced virtually all of our behavioral health grants, general fund grants into Medicaid. And so now, in order to be eligible for services in the behavioral health system, you pretty much have to be Medicaid eligible, which generally means you have to get sicker before we can do anything for you. That's particularly problematic around kids, where there are often specific services that we know could make a big difference in their success, but they're not Medicaid reimbursable because they're not medically related services. And so we've created, and you have supported, creating these individualized services. And it can be everything from, say, giving a young man or young woman who's struggling in school the opportunity to go get tutoring, to be part of the Sylvan Learning Center, just to pick one example, to participate in community activities, and to use it as incentives. One young man was determined to learn to play the electric guitar. Well, what we offered was you can have lessons if you get your act together at school. You don't get privileges if you don't do the work. And it worked. He was highly motivated in a way that he had never been before. And so not only was he able to get guitar lessons, but he learned some important skills about paying attention and working hard at school and getting good results. And that's a lesson that will be far more important to him in the long run than this particular example. Of the over 500 youth that received these individualized services, less than 1% ended up in RPTC level of care. So these are very critical services. You can see on page 11, this is our budget for Bring the Kids Home for 2011. You can see what the trust recommended in GFMH and our continued investment of MTAR in the project. The numbers in red show where there is a difference between what the trust recommended and what the governor included in his budget. In general, we're, you know, very pleased with the support of the governor in continuing this initiative. You know, we do think there are some areas that continue to need attention, and we'll continue to work with you and the administration on those over time. Again, you know, we do not envision these focus areas as being perpetual. You know, we set goals, and when we achieve that goal, we want to move on. There are many other areas in this state. Alcohol is one. Employment for our beneficiaries is another. You know, we will move on to other focus areas, but we need to get some of these closed out And we're going to need your support to do the work that we need to do to bring the kids home to a conclusion by having what we believe to be a successful development of a continuum of care. Looking on page 12, disability justice, you know, we've worked very well with the Department of Corrections and did a study which indicated that 42% of all the inmates in the Department of Corrections are trust beneficiaries. They serve longer sentences for similar crimes, as you can see in the chart on page 12. They also have a higher degree of recidivism. This is an area that we've invested significant resources with our partners to try to turn this around. You know, the Criminal Justice Working Group is trying to address this issue. But I'll tell you, in terms of impact on the state budget, at some point, really getting a cooperative approach to hammering down recidivism, in our opinion, is critical not only for the individuals involved, but for the long-term financial health of the state. I understand that the new prison is going to be full within 12 to 18 months. We'll be sending prisoners back outside again. No doubt we'll start planning for the next prison at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, not to mention the operating costs. Other states have been successful at turning that curve at the point where we develop the political will to tackle the brass ring. I think that we can make a major impact in this area in a manner not unlike Bring the Kids Home, in that if you choose to invest in those services that reduce recidivism, then you can manage your system better. And it will take everyone working together and some confidence that we actually have the strategies that we need. Again, on page 14, you can see some of the things that we've worked on in this arena. The therapeutic courts, of course, have become very central to our efforts to divert beneficiaries from corrections. And you know the basic model there is rather than just lock them up for a while and let them go and see what happens, we actually get them engaged in treatment, get them engaged in community services, get them housed, get them jobs. You know, there's nothing, if any of you have not had a chance to visit a therapeutic court, I really encourage it. I know a couple of years ago I went to the mental health court in Anchorage. A young woman who had struggled for many, many years with her addiction and had been in and out of corrections and API came on her monthly visit to the judge and explained how she was working. She had a job. She loved her apartment. You know, she was clean and sober. The judge said, you know, you are doing a fantastic job. I don't think I need to see you next month. Why don't you come back in 3 months? And this woman looked at the judge and said, oh, gee, Your Honor, are you sure I can't come back next month? Now, when you get people turned around to the point where they see coming to court as a good thing, a positive thing, because they have a chance to celebrate their success, then we've accomplished something, because that's a way different experience from what most people experience in our justice system. Again, on page 15, you can see what the trust is continuing to contribute, both in terms of MTAR and grants that we administer ourselves for 2011 in disability justice. If you turn to page 16, this is where our general fund recommendations come into play. As you can see, we were able to get some significant support from the governor for some of the key components of this. I will draw your attention to the Bethel project. You know, we do need some additional operating funds for the Bethel facility, and we need the capital funds. And this is an important project because the other day we were presented with some information, and one of the people from Bethel had taken a photo of the patient room chart in the emergency room. And they have 9 beds. And 8 of those 9 beds were filled with people that were there because of alcohol, not for other emergency medical conditions. So they have taken the bull by the horns and I think have a very good business plan and facility plan, and we're certainly hoping that we're going to be able to completely fund that and get that into operation as soon into the coming fiscal year as possible. On page 17, workforce development, this continues to be a major problem for us across all of our beneficiary service sectors. Even if you gave us all the money that we can imagine we would need, we wouldn't be able to get the workforce to provide those services. So as we've worked with our partners, including the university, you know, we've focused on recruitment and retention, wages and benefits, which comes back to, frankly, SB 32, and then training and education so that we can maintain folks in these jobs. By the way, one thing that we've learned that was a little bit surprising to me is there's a tendency to think, well, wages and benefits is what it's all about. If people have good wages and benefits, then they're going to be happy in their job and they're going to stay in those positions. It turns out when you actually talk to people, one of the biggest factors in whether they'll stay in a job is the quality of supervision. If they feel they're being supported and supervised and helped, then they have good job satisfaction and they want to stay on the job. Sometimes it's even more important than wages and benefits. If you look on page 18, you'll get an idea of what we've been able to accomplish in terms of workforce development over the last several years. Ahead for workforce development is looking at starting up a psychiatric residency program in Alaska. There is already a shortage of 20 to 25 psychiatrists. We have another 20 that are over 50, which puts them at high risk of retirement. We have, to the extent that we have had to rely on locum tenens, the quality of care is substantially lower. We need to grow our own. We need to get Alaskans engaged in these high-level professions. And so having a residency program where we can get these physicians to do their residency in Alaska, their likelihood of remaining in the state is very high. And so we'll be looking at working with you on that. Expanding the student loan repayment and other incentives for health professionals is very important in attracting and keeping our health workforce. The PhD psychologist internship will be implemented. And again, we have a number of increments in the University of Alaska program that we've recommended to continue our partnership with them. You can see on page 20, again, what the trust is proposing to contribute to this area, very substantial financial investment on our part. On page 21, you'll see that in this area, we didn't do quite so well in terms of the governor's budget. And so we'll be looking at how we can get lined up on, you know, how we need to move forward in some of the workforce development area. So that's an area that will need continued discussion and dialogue, and I'm sure we'll come to a common understanding of how to move forward. On page 22, affordable, appropriate housing. I've already talked a little bit about our housing initiatives. You know, I will point out it can be somewhat frustrating for us. We are very pleased, as you'll see in a minute, that you know, we have probably a little over $10 million committed to this area in the coming fiscal year. And I think what's a little frustrating for us is that's in comparison to over $300 million for weatherization. So there's an order of magnitude difference in the level of effort we're putting towards some of these services versus other programs that are no doubt extremely valuable. I myself am participating in the energy rebate program, but I have to say, on just a personal level, sometimes I wonder why you're going to give me money for weatherization, and we can't seem to address the needs of the homeless in the state. So that's more of a personal commentary. If you look at page 23, this gives you an idea of what's possible when we have resources to apply to housing. This is our Bridge Home program, and you can see that by taking beneficiaries that are coming out of institutional care and supporting them, as I said, in supported housing, you can see the dramatic decrease in admits to API, the dramatic decrease in admits to corrections, and corresponding decreases in days in API and days in corrections. Every one of those decreases is an economic benefit. And this is the type of thing that with additional resources we can expand our ability to serve these folks, particularly, again, as I said earlier, folks coming out of corrections. This is one of the main strategies for keeping those folks from going back into the correctional system. Again, on page 24, looking forward to 2011, again, we're very pleased that the governor's budget has $10 million in it to begin implementing the 10-year plan. We're very happy with our partnership with AHFC, and we're starting to finally get people to understand the housing first concept. You know, several of our communities are struggling with a group of chronic public inebriates that are taking up our private spaces, that are at risk by camping out in extreme conditions. As you know, Anchorage has had a rash of deaths in the last year among this population. You know, and the answer, believe it or not, is not all that complicated. It's housing first. And we've looked around the country and found a number of programs that have been very successful at this. In fact, there are some under-the-radar housing first projects in Alaska. Sitka has one. Anchorage has a couple. And the model is pretty simple. For years, we demanded that people achieve a state of sobriety before we were going to house them that they had never been able to achieve. And so consequently, they didn't get housed. What we've learned is that when you offer housing without that precondition, they will not only take you up on that opportunity, but their drinking is reduced in that environment. They get healthier and have more opportunities to get positively engaged in the community. And when we looked at this project in Seattle, which is sort of the most heavily evaluated of the Housing First programs, we learned that it put to rest two myths about this population. The first is that they choose to be homeless. Well, now, when they were offered housing in Seattle, when they took the list of the 100 most highest consumers of public resources, the emergency rooms, the jails, the hospitals, CSP pickups, police calls, fire department calls, when they had the list of the top 100 highest utilizers, which, by the way, were costing well over $100,000 apiece in public resources, and they offered them housing without the precondition of sobriety, they had to go through 78 people to fill 75 slots. 78 people to fill 75 slots. So these people aren't wanting to be homeless. The other myth that was put to rest is that, well, they choose to drink. Among the people that went into that project, the average number of times through treatment was 15. Now, if you're choosing to drink, why would you put yourself through treatment unsuccessfully 15 times? Frankly, there is an end of the spectrum here where this disease is so powerful that demanding sobriety as a condition for basic housing services is just not going to work. And it hasn't worked across the country, and this does work. One of the things the trust is doing is working with a group both in Anchorage and in Fairbanks that are looking into this. And the mayor of Anchorage is open to this idea because he recognizes that what we've been doing has not been working. And the trust is sponsoring trips down to Seattle to see the 1811 East Lake project. They have been very welcoming of showing people what they're up to. And one of the things that happens when people visit there is that the program matches them to their counterparts. So if we send the chief of police, then they'll hook them up with the Seattle chief of police. If we send a business person that's worried about the impact on property values, then we connect them with the manager of the Marriott that's two blocks away from this program. So we try to match folks to people that have a similar perspective to theirs. And so in the interim, within, of course, whatever the ethics limits are, if any of you are interested in actually going down and looking at some of these programs, the trust would be happy to put together a site visit so that you can actually see these programs in operation. Looking ahead again, you can see on page 25 our budget recommendations and where we are. As you can see, there are only two small areas in which the governor didn't support our recommendations. We're very pleased with the support that the governor has given to this initiative and look forward to continuing our results. And then on page 26 and 27, these are our beneficiary projects. The trust is going to continue to carry these. We believe that beneficiaries can do a lot to support each other without having them have to be totally dependent upon government-funded services. And we think our projects in this area have been very successful. We have not yet convinced the mental health, behavioral health system of care that these projects have to be integrated fully into our mental health system, but we're getting there. And so we will continue to fund these until we're able to successfully demonstrate their effectiveness and the role they should have in the program. And again, on page 28, you can see our results and the projects we've been doing. And on page 29, you get a little bit of a look at the budget picture. As you can see, as I said, the trust is carrying a huge amount of the load in this area to the tune of nearly $4 million. And I'll close by referencing the governor's domestic violence and substance abuse initiative. I can't tell you how pleased we are that the governor and the attorney general have taken this bold step to try to address this scourge across the state of Alaska. We have been working with both of them on ways that that initiative can be enhanced that would increase its likelihood of success. The enforcement and accountability pieces that are currently in the initiative are very important. We need accountability, we need enforcement, but we continue to believe there are other pieces to the puzzle that need to be addressed. Integrating behavioral health into our system of care in domestic violence and substance abuse, looking at how we can address the needs of the kids that are witnesses to domestic violence, where we know they have a much higher likelihood of becoming victims and perpetrators in the future and having difficulties in school. And so we're working very closely with them. And on the House side, Representative Faircloth has pulled together a group to look at how we might enhance the governor's initiative. And there was a meeting yesterday at which the governor attended for an hour and the attorney general attended the entire 4 hours. And there were a number of other commissioners there, providers from the community, other folks. And I think there's a lot of really positive energy. And again, from our perspective, if we go back to the type of strategic approach that the trust has used and apply it to this area, we need to get a work group together. We need to get rigorous about how we're going to monitor the data and monitor our strategies. I think that with the continuing support of the governor and the attorney general, we can turn the curve in this area, and it's critical to do so. But there are some obvious gaps. I mean, just to give you one, if you're a victim of sexual assault and you decide that your substance abuse, was part of what put you at risk, and you want to do something about it, we just put you on a wait list with everybody else. That's not right. And again, it's not blaming the victim, but people that want to take responsibility for controlling their own risk need to be helped in that regard. And not just by rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic by saying, well, okay, we'll put them to the top of the list. Well, that just means other people that are trying to get their life together aren't going to have that opportunity. So, again, we look forward to working with the administration and you all in looking at how to ensure the success of that very important initiative as well.
So thank you for that presentation, Jeff Jesse. One question that I have is that we have serious problems in this state on suicide throughout the state of Alaska. And I wonder if you might comment on why that aspect is not, in this budget, not being addressed by the Mental Health Trust Authority.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there's no question that suicide is a very serious problem across the state. We are working with our partners like the Suicide Prevention Council, the boards and others, the tribal health organizations to address this. We helped fund a suicide follow-back study a couple of years ago trying to get a handle on what the causation factors are. The fact is that, like you, we need to have some focus to our efforts. For example, many of the primary prevention activities that are contemplated as part of the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Initiative are applicable to many different issues, not only domestic violence, but suicide, criminal behavior, risky sexual behavior, etc. So we are working in this area. We do not have a focus area specifically on suicide, but we're well aware of the problem. And certainly want to support working with our partners to address the issue.
So you don't see any, in the near future, any movement on that major problem, even though the legislature, I guess, has formed the task force to try to address the high rate of suicide in the state?
Well, I do see progress. If that task force can come forward with some evidence-based strategies that are data-driven that can ensure that we're going to get success, I absolutely see that as something that can happen sooner rather than later.
Because of all the problems that are facing the people of Alaska, this one is has so much finality to it, and it seems as though that's an area that needs to be addressed. Are there further questions, Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, thanks for being here today and your presentation. Two questions, one about traumatic brain injury. A number of folks have spoken to me and seen the connection between in your populations you serve and programs you work with in the effects of traumatic brain injury. So I'd ask you to speak to that briefly. And then the second question, has to do with the fact that the state of Alaska currently, or we as an appropriating body, appropriate only half of the current tax on alcoholic beverages and wholesale, or all the state taxes on alcohol. The current tax, only about half is appropriated each year in our budget for substance abuse prevention and treatment. And you spoke to the need for greater capacity. A lot of folks are coming together, a very strange coalition of faith-based folks, liquor retailers, service providers, treatment providers, to try and say that we should increase that amount that we appropriate for treatment services. Could the system absorb a significant increase if we were to muster the political will to appropriate more money for substance abuse treatment? Where would that capacity, where would we put more beds in the system if we made that budget decision?
Well, let me take your first question first, the traumatic brain injury. You're exactly right. We are learning more every day about how pervasive traumatic brain injury is among our beneficiaries, which initially are presenting with other disabilities. Whether it's now looking at screening, you know, the behavioral health system now screens routinely for traumatic brain injury and are finding a very significant overlap. If you look in corrections, people are quite surprised at the high numbers of people that are in corrections with brain injuries. They did a study a couple of years ago of the correctional transfers from corrections to API, folks that were so challenging in their mental health behaviors that they ended up having to go from corrections to the state hospital. And 80% of them had a co-occurring history of traumatic brain injury. So we're learning more and more that, yes, in fact, this is an often an underlying co-occurring issue, particularly because we produce so many brain injuries in this state due to the way we recreate, subsistence activities, our economy. It produces a lot of those problems. So we're trying to work hard. The trust funds the Traumatic Brain Injury Network to continue this work. One thing that I've personally been involved with is, you know, we're too small of a state to have three systems of care for traumatic brain injury. The state, the tribal health system, and the Department of Defense and VA. And so we've been trying to work on how we can collaborate better among those systems. And the tribal health system and the VA, DOD, have some ability to do that because they're all part of the federal healthcare partnership. But the state hasn't really been able to integrate into that. And I'll tell you, you know, I used to think working with state bureaucracy was challenging, but you try to work with the VA and the Department of Defense, and you can't even find out who made any of the decisions or who to talk to. So that's been very challenging, but we're making progress on pulling that together, and we need one system of care that can be accessed by people regardless of where they're coming from. And as you all know, we're getting more and more folks coming back from the wars with traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. So absolutely, that's a big issue that we need to keep working on. As to the alcohol tax, well, you know, there's no question we need additional services. Workforce will be a challenge. You know, even with significant additional dollars, you know, we will need to gear up for the workforce. Where could those resources be best used? I think a great opportunity is to continue to partner with our tribal health system. You know, the state needs to do, in my opinion, a better job of partnering with tribal health. You know, and so that's one area that I would look to. And then certainly, even in urban areas, there's a great lack of substance abuse services. So could we absorb additional resources and enhance our capacity? Yes. Could we do that in 1 year? No. It would take a more strategic view of how to ramp up those services over time, and my recommendation would be that if we go down that road, we again try to be very specific about what is the outcome we're trying to affect. And how are we going to know that any additional resources are moving us in the direction that we want to achieve, whether it's a reduction in domestic violence and sexual assault, whether it's a reduction in recidivism into corrections, you know, what is it that you want to see accomplished? And then we can talk about how to best utilize resources to direct us in that area. And as you know, the trust paid for a study several years ago about the cost of alcohol abuse in the state, and it's staggering. It's well over $400 million a year, probably over $500 million a year now. You know, when you start to look at corrections and the court system and law enforcement and hospital care and child protection and lost productivity, you know, alcohol is huge. And as you said, we're only applying even half of the taxes that we collect to the problem. So certainly that's something that we can work on. And just, again, on sort of an editorial note, one of my recent frustrations has been, you know, one of the things that we utilize to encourage kids to be productive is to get them engaged in sports. And more, the alcohol industry has been successful at associating drinking with sports. And it's frustrating to think that in some ways, when we get kids involved in sports activities, in essence, we're delivering them to the alcohol industry. And I'm not exactly sure what one can do about that, but you know, if you go and attend any sporting event in Alaska, you will look a long time before you find one that isn't heavily associated with alcohol.
Thank you.
Besides high school basketball. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relatively short question on the topic of bringing the kids home. We have a fair number of facilities in the state of Alaska, and the numbers have been coming down. I was having a little difficulty determining from your charts what numbers have come down. I see the out-of-state admits down dramatically, but I'm not sure if the number 752 in 04 was the number admitted in that year, or if that was the baseline that we're starting with. And regardless of that, just where are we at today as far as bringing them home, and how much of the capacity that we have in the state is being utilized? I know we had some difficulty in the new Fairbanks facility, so if you could briefly address that realm of questions.
Yeah, the 740 number were the number of kids that were served at least at some time during that year in an out-of-state facility. The high water mark for the kids at a point in time out-of-state was about 425. Right now, I don't know what today's number is, but we've been right around 117. So we've gone from a high water mark of 435 or so down to under 120. In terms of in-state capacity, well, let me back up. We started this initiative from, in a way, the wrong end. If you were really going to design a children's system of care, you'd be working on the home and community-based level. And only after all those resources had been used would you move up into residential and ultimately into RPTC care and then maybe even out of state. We started on the other end because we didn't believe there'd be a lot of support for spending millions of dollars at the very low end and promising you in 10 years you would see a change. But as the initiatives progressed, we are no longer looking at increasing residential beds. Now we're looking at what community supports can we provide earlier in the issue so that we don't get to where we're having to pay for residential services. And one of the challenges we have is that, by and large, the families involved are not self-referrers. They tend not to go seek out behavioral health services as early as we would like. And so we formed an education subcommittee because, in our view, the biggest partner in this early identification is the school. It's likely to be the teacher who's the first one to identify that something's not right here. And so if we can get a good partnership going with education, we can start working with those families and kids earlier. You know, one of the problems with our system is that when we wait to do anything until the kid is out of the home, then the system tends to say, oh, well, we got this kid with problems. If we just fix this kid, everything will be good. Well, these kids, by and large, didn't spring from the head of Zeus. There are issues that they have had to deal with often in their families that are at the root of this. And so now what we're trying to do is not focus so much on beds, but focus on those lower-level interventions that can prevent them from getting to where you're having to pay for residential services. One of the reasons that we tried to emphasize small facilities instead of larger institutional residential capacity is if we are successful at this lower level, we may need fewer beds. And when you use small group homes for your residential capacity, if it turns out that you need fewer beds, those facilities can be converted into, frankly, single-family homes and be sold on the market and taken out of the inventory. That's not possible with larger institutional settings.
Just if I may, I missed the 117. If we did make use of all the capacity we had in the state, and I understand the direction probably should be different than maybe just institutionalizing people in-state versus institutionalizing them out-of-state, and I would agree with that, but of those that are, I'm trying to make sure that the capacity that we have is being fully utilized to bring as many home, because that seems to be part of the approach of actually causing these kids or people to be brought back into the community, not physically brought back into the community, but mentally as well as everything else, so that they can be more useful and not institutionalized, is obviously bringing them home so we can work on that aspect of it, because I think where they are outside, I don't think there's a great deal of that taking place. That's just my own thought. So of the 117, if we decided today that we wanted to have as many of those back in state, what capacity are we lacking? Or,
well, Senator Thomas, through the chair.
I know there's room in Fairbanks, so I...
Yeah, Senator Thomas, through the chair. Yeah, we have vacant beds in the state, but at this stage of workforce and technology development, if you will, those empty beds are not able to provide the level of care that the kids that are out of state right now require. Now, we're getting better over time at doing that, but the kids that are remaining outside tend to be the most severe situations with multiple problems, and you know, the point was never just to bring them back to whatever it was that we could throw together. You have to bring them back to a program that's capable of meeting their needs, and that's why we set up the utilization review system in the Division of Behavioral Health in order to match those kids to services in state. And then as we identify among those 117 that you refer to that are still out of state, as we identify particular programmatic needs, then we're working with our in-state programs to build their capacity up to where they can handle those kids. In some cases, such as the facility in Fairbanks, they haven't been able to maintain a level of service to take level 5 kids. And so at least temporarily, they're taking even lower level of kids. So they at this point wouldn't even be able to take an RPTC level of care child. So again, it's a question of matching the capacity of the programs to meet the needs of the kids, not just bringing them back and sticking them in a bed in a program if we don't have confidence that they're going to be able to meet their needs.
Okay, I understand that. And just one more thing, a little bit different subject matter is on your slide 12, the problem / community need, 42% of those incarcerated in the Department of Corrections are trust beneficiaries. Is that in-state as well as out-of-state, that number, that 42%?
That would include all of the correctional inmates. Now, I don't know if it's 42% of the inmates that are out-of-state. You see what I mean? It's 42% of the whole. How they might be distributed between the folks in Colorado and in-state, I don't know.
That was my question. My question was if the 42% includes all that have run through the correction system.
It includes them all, but I don't know what the percentage of the out-of-state folks would be beneficiaries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Karen Rayfield, do you have any closing comments on mental health?
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say that it's been my pleasure to work with Mr. Jesse here the last couple of years on developing the budget that you see before you. I think our working relationship has been very positive, along with those of other commissioners that are engaged in the behavioral health issues from a number of perspectives, particularly Commissioner Hogan, but also those involved with the criminal justice working group. And I think we've seen some success in what's in the budget before you and the results that we're achieving as a result of that. So I just appreciate that.
Thank you for those comments, and thank you, Mr. Jesse, for that presentation. That brings us to the two remaining items that we left open from yesterday's meeting. The first one, deferred maintenance. I think the committee had asked for further detail, and I think the administration is continuing to work on those. Ms. Rayfield?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I apologize. We had prepared and submitted some additional information to you this morning that I asked to be recalled. There were some problems with that. But we will get that to you as soon as possible. We have agency representatives in the room this morning and on the line. If there are specific questions about any of the department's deferred maintenance requests, if the committee might want to go through those, I'm sure we could.
Is there specific requests? Seeing none, we will be looking forward to that deferred maintenance list from the administration. We also left open the supplemental on capital appropriations because it was a little bit more lengthy, so that committee members would have the opportunity to review those and to see if there are other further questions on Senate Bill 254, the supplemental on capital and other appropriations. Seeing none, then we will await for that. We will be having a meeting tomorrow. I don't have the agenda. Senator Stedman will be chairing that meeting. And are there any final items that committee members might like to bring up at this time? Seeing none, we're adjourned.